right, so Spread Aviation Nation, this is Matt.
This is Rob.
And we are here with episode 28. We've got
just
a bunch of things
the
to
heck out of that one. I'm so sorry.
Talk about. It's fine. We got a bunch of things to talk about today. Hope you enjoyed our Oshkosh episodes as well as our last episode,
which was on Nationals and the interview.
Yeah, it was good. Good episode. How you been, Rob?
I've been well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well, prepping for surgery in December.
Yeehaw.
Yep. Going to get some mouth work done.
So Matt may have a lisp in the future.
That'll be interesting.
And we're going to be okay with that.
We'll talk about that as Rob scratches his chin. So I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you were just using a software, and was it, was X something?
X split. Yeah.
So is that like when you break up with your ex again?
Well, if there's software for that to make that easier, awesome. But no, this is for capturing the video and audio in multiple tracks and overlays for the computer to create videos, content, as well as do live streaming to YouTube and things like that. So we're kind of preparing for the future, getting ready for big things here at Spread Aviation and our YouTube channel, Spread Aviation. And hopefully we'll have some more community interaction with that as well. So right now I'm working on some of the chat plugins for any kind of live streaming.
Cool.
I want to have a regular schedule for live streaming things. Yeah. And I'm thinking whenever The Bachelor is back on, I know I get Monday nights from 8 to 10 where Hillary doesn't need me for anything at that point, because the TV has her attention. So maybe that could be a possible time slot.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Anyway,
I would enjoy some live
content.
That would be awesome. So let's do a transition here. So speaking of,
I got this one.
I had a really good one.
Do you have a specific thing you want to talk about, or you want to go into our topics here?
I want to go into our topics.
Okay, so speaking of online content, some of our topics for today are actually coming from people who have reached out online. And Matt, you may have at one point flown 4791 Gulf.
I have. I also flew a plane with Carb Heat in Princeton, New Jersey when I went up with my friend.
Right. It was probably an N model or a Mike model 172, something that was a little bit older, but
I have absolutely no idea what
to do. That's okay. We're going to talk about it right now. So take notes. We're talking about non-fuel injected engines here, engines that have carburetors on them. And carburetors are a very simple means of mixing fuel with air for the engine to burn. And it's old school technology. It's been around for a very long time. And most of the airplanes that we fly today for general aviation have updraft or side draft carburetors, just meaning that the air is either flowing up from the bottom or in from the side. But what happens inside of a carburetor is air flows through it because the pistons, when they are going down, I'm using air quotes here, down, away from the intake valve, they are pulling, creating a vacuum of space for the atmosphere to fill. And so the atmosphere flows through the carburetor. And as it flows through the carburetor, there's a venturi, a narrowed section that creates a low pressure. And then there's a little nozzle in that low pressure that pulls fuel out of the float bowl in the carburetor and mixes it with the air, where it then goes into the cylinder, the intake valve and the exhaust valve close, the piston comes up and compresses all of that, and then the spark plug goes off, releasing all that energy from the fuel and air, and that pushes the piston down, and then as the piston goes back up, the exhaust valve opens, and all that spent gas goes out the exhaust for the cycle to repeat itself over these series of four strokes: intake, compression, power, and exhaust. Now, when that fuel gets drawn in from the incoming air in the carburetor, it vaporizes. And what happens during this vaporization to the pressure is an extreme drop in temperature. So the manufacturers, wanting to prevent any drop in temperature from bringing moisture out and that moisture freezing, installed a function called carb heat, where they take warm air from around the exhaust. Can you think of a place where a time in the 172 that you've flown where we were taking warm air from around the exhaust and putting it somewhere, Matt?
Cabin heat.
Yeah, cabin heat. Exactly like the cabin heat. We're taking warm air from a shroud around the exhaust, and now we're ducting that air into the carburetor in an effort to raise the temperature in there to keep it above freezing. So the carb heat, recommended use, when should a pilot turn that on? Well, on the tachometer of an airplane that's equipped with carb heat, there's a green arc. And if the RPM that you're currently applying is within that green arc, you generally don't need carb heat. Now, I'm assuming airborne operations, because when we're idling on the ground, you don't want to use carb heat there because the air is unfiltered and you don't want to be sucking in dirt and pollen and debris and anything else that is really more concentrated at the ground. Whereas when you're in the air, so it's much cleaner air.
So do you not want to use cabin heat when you're on the ground either?
No, because I'm not concerned. I'm not concerned with that stuff coming into the cabin, but metal parts rubbing in close proximity with close tolerances, getting pieces of debris on it would not be good for the longevity of those metal parts.
Got it.
They would wear faster. So we want to protect our engine. Whereas I can breathe pollen all day long. I mean, I might get a little runny nose, but that's just allergies. So we want to apply carb heat if we're operating the engine below the green arc. Now, carb heat does change the mixture of the air fuel charge that's going into the engine, and that can rob a little bit of power. So if you're looking for maximum power out of your engine, say for a go around or on takeoff, you don't want that carb heat on. Okay, so you want it off for go arounds, you want it off for takeoffs. Now, I've seen a bunch of different thoughts on when to shut that carb heat off, and kind of depends on the different schools of thought, where some pilots and instructors recommend shutting off the carb heat on short final. So if you do have to go around, you're not waiting for that carb heat to shut off, it's right there right away.
Is there a delay?
No, it's mechanical.
Right. So what do you mean by waiting for it to go off? Just meaning fitting it into your schedule.
Yeah, kind of fitting it into your schedule. Whereas, like with the Piper, the throttle quadrant is in the center of the console, and then to the right of it is the alternate air or a carb heat valve. So in that case, you have to take your hand off the throttle to then shut that off. Whereas in the Cessna 172, the carb heat is to the left of the throttle immediately, and you can just extend your thumb and push them both in together. Okay, so you can shut them off together in that scenario, but you can't really shut them off together in the Piper. So it kind of depends on what school you kind of came from.
Right.
And then there's even the shutting it off after you're already on the ground. You know, it's not a big deal as part of your after landing checklist. In this part, I really don't have a preference. If you're getting an aircraft checkout from someplace or your flight instructor wants you to do it a certain way, do it that way. Not a big deal. But there's some other, and majorly, we use the carb heat to eliminate ice, okay, or the potential buildup of ice. It's a preventative tool. But if you were flying along and you started to notice that you kept having to add power because the RPM was dropping in your airplane, that may be an indication that, hey, I need to apply this carb heat now. Even though you were operating in the green arc already, you may have to apply a carb heat. Well, wait a minute. Rob, you said earlier, if I'm in the green arc, I should have you asking this question.
Rob, you said earlier, if you're in the green arc.
Yeah, you shouldn't need the carb heat.
Right.
Okay, but this is the fun thing about physics. I love physics. I'm a huge fan. But when the fuel vaporizes, the temperature drops, right? And if we think back to spring mornings, what's normally on our car or our airplane or on the grass waking up?
Dew, moisture,
okay? And we're here in the Northeast, which we have a decent amount of humidity, right? Well, that dew and that moisture being on the grass came from temperature change from already moist air. Well, inside the carburetor, I talked about the Venturi, which is creating a pressure change. And anytime you have a pressure change, you have a temperature change. And if the temperature goes below the dew point, where's the moisture in the air going to go? It's going to come out. Okay. And if we're dropping the temperature to freezing, what's that moisture going to do as soon as it contacts some cold metal?
Freeze.
It's going to freeze. And that's going to start to choke that air inlet inside the carburetor. So now we're not getting as much airflow. If we're not getting as much airflow, we're not getting as much fuel. If we're not getting as much of the air fuel charge, you're losing power.
Makes sense.
Okay, so if you see a drop in power, you need to apply that carb heat and expect, as that carb heat comes on, expect to get an even rougher running engine for a couple of seconds, because now that ice is melting and the engine is ingesting water. Well, it can't burn water. It can actually increase compression ratio and things like that very temporarily, but that's a whole other topic. However, our engine isn't set up for that, so it doesn't like it. And then it starts to run better and better. Now, Matt, what temperatures outside, what outside air temperature would you expect to actually have the biggest threat of carb ice, of induction ice, of carb ice, when you're flying along? What temperature would you expect to have the biggest threat?
Zero Celsius.
Zero Celsius, right at freezing, right? The actual threat range is more like 15 to 22-ish degrees Celsius, somewhere in between 60 and 80, 85 degrees Fahrenheit.
Interesting.
Because at those temperature ranges, you have capability for the air to hold more water. Okay. Uh-huh. It's warmer, so there's more space in between the molecules for other molecules to fit in. When is it more humid for us? In the summer or in the winter?
Summer.
Yeah, it's in the summer. In the winter, you got to moisturize because your skin gets all dry because it's too humid out, right? Did I just admit something? Anyway.
Oh. Ask Sarah. Like, the only thing that I yelled out last week for like 4 days straight was that she didn't have a humidifier set up yet. And that we were out of moisturizer because my face was dry. So you want to talk about who the expert moisturizer is here.
So yeah, like as the temperatures get colder, there's less moisture in the air. And so there's actually, once you get below about negative 10 or negative 15 degrees Celsius, your threat of icing is pretty much gone. And so if you're at zero C outside, the air going through the carburetor is getting reduced to like negative 20, negative 30. There's no threat of ice there. It's too cold. Anything that forms is instantaneous ice crystal, and that can't stick to the walls, and it just moves right through the motor. Okay, so our actual high threat time is late summer, early summer, early fall, late spring, when it's really warm and humid out. You have high humidity and those kind of moderate temperatures, 75, 80, 80 degrees, that's where you're your most threat for
carbon. Like 2-3 weeks ago would have been a...
Yeah. And New England, you know, we get it a little bit earlier. The Midwest gets a little bit later. Your latitude is going to determine when those scenarios happen, and your proximity to water.
So let me ask you a question then. Where's the when in doubt on this? Obviously, you've mentioned you don't want carb heat on when you're going around because you need to have that power. You don't want carb heat on when you're taking off. Is there a time where you could have carb heat on that would be bad? You mentioned on the ground as well. But when in doubt, can you turn the carb heat on?
Knowing the high probability times for carb ice is when you want to turn that on. So whenever you're going to pull the throttle down below the green arc on the tachometer, carb heat on. If you are seeing drops in RPM that you can't explain by a wandering throttle, carb heat on and watch for those indications: rough running engine, loss of power, loss of RPM. And if you're flying an airplane that has a carburetor with a manifold pressure gauge and a constant speed propeller, like we talked about in the last episode, you aren't going to see a change in RPM because the constant speed propeller is doing its work to maintain RPM as you lose power. So you'll actually start to see a loss of manifold pressure with that induction icing happening because the manifold pressure gauge is reading the amount of atmosphere coming into the induction system. And that's going to be choked off by the formation of ice. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a drop in manifold pressure there.
Now, how likely is somebody new to flying, how likely are they to encounter a plane with carb heat?
That's a good question. You know, as flight schools modernize fleets, as the big flight schools modernize fleets, they sell off their older 172s. And so your littler flight schools are going to be flying the older aircraft. Even executive flyers in 2016 still had a Mike model and a November model. And it wasn't until really getting towards the end in 2017 where they sold off the Mike model, and it's still flying with the company that they sold it to. So the stuff is still out there.
Yeah.
Pipers have alternate air, but generally they're running, or I can't say this, you'll need to learn how your aircraft is set up to know whether you need to use that carb heat more often or not. I have seen some setups where you're running your induction piping through the oil pan, and the oil pan is carrying 140 to 190 to 225 degree oil. So, I mean, there's a lot of latent heat right there, but nothing guarantees that that's making it all the way to the carburetor. So you kind of got to be aware of what the recommendation is for your aircraft that you're flying on how to use that system properly. And if you don't know, ask the CFI that's familiar with that aircraft. And that's going to reference the pilot operating handbook, whatever the manufacturer has put with it. And that way you learn how to operate this thing safely and prevent having to use extraordinary skill at a later time if that engine stops working the way we want it to.
Got it.
Oh, one more thing. Oh, sorry.
Go.
In very, very, very cold temperatures, do not use carb heat, because the carb heat could actually bring the temperature range inside the carburetor up to that 0 to -10 range. And then you actually put yourself at risk for induction icing with the carb heat on, and you've got no way of getting rid of it.
That makes sense.
You can't heat it up anymore.
So in really cold temperatures, you never want to use carb.
You would not want to use carb heat. So like
even when not in the green.
Yeah. So like flying in Alaska on a very, very cold day, doing your descent, you might not want to use it.
So do you have a temperature that people can remember that says, okay, if the outside air temperature is below this, never use carb heat?
Unfortunately, I don't have a rule of thumb like that. Mm. But I could definitely say somewhere below, you know, -5, you're probably safe to not use carb heat.
Celsius.
Yes, -5 Celsius. Yeah.
So I have a question for you. What do you do when you whip an airplane? What do you get?
Whip an airplane?
Yeah, when you like throw an airplane into a blender, what do you get?
I don't know.
Rudder.
I don't get it.
Instead of butter.
Rudder. Oh, jeez.
So speaking of rudder.
I have to explain it to you.
I know, it's pretty bad. Speaking of rudder.
That was a segue?
You wanted to talk about rudder usage.
Rudder usage. Well, yes, this was another question
that
got posed to us by you, the listener. Rudder usage is one of those things that is actually hardest, I think, to learn how to teach.
Okay.
It's hard to learn on your own.
Well, the funny part is that I heard of the book Stick and Rudder Skills.
No, right? Just Stick and Rudder.
Or Stick and Rudder in general.
Yeah.
And then I was told, yeah, well, a pilot that has good stick and rudder skills, I mean, that's a good pilot, but stick and rudder, there's some things that were wrong.
He got some stuff wrong. He got some stuff right. But,
okay, so keep going.
A pilot who has good stick and rudder skills is one that can use their hands and feet together. And I had a very hard time during my flight training at Kent State University of figuring out what my feet were supposed to do and when, and I didn't have a flight instructor who could really talk me through it. And I met my mentor when my hometown airport bought a Citabria, a tailwheel airplane. It was a 1974 7ECA, 115 horsepower, awesome, beautiful, lovely airplane. Heel brakes, which is a whole nother challenge in itself, but tailwheel airplanes demand that you know how to use your feet. And during my initial training on the ground, My mentor was telling me a story of when he went to Kent State University and was taught by Richard Schwabe, who was a World War II pilot, and he was in the commercial class, ground school, and Schwabe said, "What's the rudders for?" And he points at my mentor. My mentor stands up, as you did back in the day, and said, "Sir, the rudder is to compensate for the adverse yaw developed by the downward displaced aileron." And Schwabe goes, "No! It's to keep the god ball in the center!" And so, oh, okay, keep the ball in the center. All right, got it. Well, sweet. But if you're watching the ball,
right,
the ball is a lag instrument. It's delayed. You're going to be reacting to things that have already happened in the past if you're only focusing on what's happening with the ball. So we need to understand what forces take the ball out of the center.
Does that mean that the ball is really useless in turns? Because if it's a lagging instrument, I mean, it's is it useless going into a turn? Maybe it's useful in a turn.
I mean, I can't say that it's useless, but you are getting 5 second old information.
Yeah.
So once you're in the turn, you can check the quality of your turn up to that point, up to 5 seconds ago, and how you've been doing. But it's not just about turns either.
Yeah.
And there are critical times, like takeoff, when you should not be staring at the ball.
Right.
And you should be looking outside. And so we need to, as pilots, understand what forces will take the ball out of center and how to anticipate those forces coming on. So there's a handful of turning tendencies that we've learned. Matt, do you remember turning tendencies?
I do.
Name a couple.
Torque.
Okay.
P factor. Forget the third one.
Well, there's four. So spiraling slipstream.
The one that hits the tail.
That's spiraling slipstream. Yep.
Can't remember the fourth.
Gyroscopic precession.
Yes, right.
Okay. So for the most part, the three of those have a very large effect on us on takeoff when we're on the ground. And for the most part, they all have a very strong effect on us at high power settings and low airspeeds. Okay. Because then you don't have the benefit of the aerodynamic stability of the aircraft to counteract those torques coming from the engine. I'm referring to them as torques because torque is twist, and we can actually measure twist about the three axes. Your hand is up like you have a question.
This I do have a question.
This is an audio podcast. Nobody.
I didn't want to interrupt you, though.
No, it's great.
So now I have a question of, okay, on rotation, if you don't have a ball, or if you're not meant to look at the ball, or let's pretend your ball is broken, how do you know you're coordinated climbing right after rotation, right after takeoff?
Okay, I mean, let's take it back to even before that.
Okay.
You're on the runway, you're adding power, and you're looking straight ahead, and what do you see? Well, the nose is probably at this point in an American engined airplane going to be yawing to the left.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, so here you have torque, which is planting the left tire firmer into the runway. Because it's a rolling force, which once you're on the runway, you can't roll. So now it just presses that tire harder. So it's harder for that tire to roll. So it yaws you to the left. You have spiraling slipstream hitting the tail, and that's yawing the nose a little bit to the left. And in a tricycle gear airplane, you don't really have any P factor, and there's no gyroscopic precession happening right now. So in a tricycle airplane, you only have two left turning tendencies acting on you, and that can actually, it makes life easier. It makes it easier to learn the airplane. But that's why there's a tailwheel endorsement, because in a tailwheel endorsement, you got P factors. So there's three left turning tendencies. Anyway, so you've only got two to compensate for there. So you got to step on the rudders.
Yep.
As you rotate and bring go from a level flight attitude to a nose high attitude, gyroscopic precession at that point actually generates, while you are changing pitch, a right yaw in that moment. So that cancels out maybe spiraling slipstream, and torque just went away because the wheels broke earth.
Right.
Okay, so that one's kind of gone. It was getting weaker anyway as we accelerated and aerodynamic stabilities were taking effect. So here we are, nose high. VY attitude is established. So the aircraft is no longer changing pitch. It is now on like 7 degrees or 10 degrees or 12 degrees, whatever the performance of your airplane is. It's now established at this attitude. Gyroscopic precession is gone. Spiraling slipstream is there. Torque is kind of gone. And now we've got P factor. P factor stands for pitch, and here we are pitched up, which generates a left-turning tendency. Well, we're back to having now two left-turning tendencies. So what rudder would I have to apply to compensate for those right now?
Right rudder.
Right rudder. And you've heard that a thousand times as a student. And
I believe it's been 784,000 times.
That's about right. And if
I've
you multiply...
Been
and I've got 7,000 hours, so multiply that by whatever. I've said it. I've said it a lot. And I'll keep saying it as long as the aircraft is uncoordinated. So here we are on this climb, high power setting, low airspeed, decently high pitch attitude. We've got some left turning tendencies. As we go to level off, we push forward on the yoke. The nose comes down. Well, that's a pitch, which generates a gyroscopic precession.
And temporarily, because of the angle of attack at that point, you're going to have to apply left, or theoretically, you might have to apply left rudder, right?
No, because now gyroscopic precession, because the nose is coming down, creates a left yaw. So I've got P factor, I've got spiraling slipstream, and now as the nose comes down, I'm adding a third.
Oh, right.
Left turn.
It's just when you're descending, you might have...
Now that's P factor. Yeah. Now a power on descent, if you are pitched down, now instead of when you were pitched up, the descending blade took a bigger bite of air.
Okay, so question on this. The reason I just asked about...
Oh, did I not explain P factor? I didn't explain P factor.
Well, I'm more curious about the relative wind, because when you're climbing, the relative wind is here.
Nope. Yep. It is equal and opposite flight path, but flight path is not equal and opposite pitch attitude. So you may be pitched to 7 degrees, but your actual flight path may only be like, I don't know, 5 degrees. Because you got 2 degrees of AOA or something like that.
Right. So you're it's still not straight and level.
We're in a climb?
We're in a climb.
Yeah.
The relative wind is not going to be coming from the horizon. So my question is, isn't it there at some point, theoretically, a point where if you're going from a climb attitude to leveling off with the horizon, that at some point you're gonna be in a negative AOA relative to the relative wind?
If you push hard enough.
The AOA adjusts, the relative wind is adjusting as you're making that change to the point where you're not gonna necessarily need to apply left rudder.
No, because it's not just about AOA and it's not just about E factor.
We can edit this.
But you are bringing things back in line. And, right. And it's a very done. No, you're asking great questions because you're visualizing a very complex a scenario. And it's one that if we tried to put it into a book, the book would be a million pages.
Yeah.
And each page would be just minutely different from the one before it. And it's a dynamic, ever-changing situation scenario with forces that are kind of going all over the place. And so when you are pitched up, you do have P factor. The descending blade is taking a bigger bite of air, producing more thrust on that side of the aircraft. And in this case, the right side of the aircraft has a little more pull forward, and that yaws the aircraft to the left. Whereas when you're in a power on descent, the more power, kind of the more obvious, you will notice that the ascending blade has a higher angle of attack to its relative wind, and it's taking a bigger bite of air, and you actually need a little bit of left rudder in a descent, on a powered descent. Now, if you did your simulated engine out and chopped it all the way to idle, you wouldn't notice this because you're not producing the power to create the differential in thrust.
Now, when you're doing a negative G maneuver in aerobatics, are you typically applying left rudder as you're doing that? Because
I'm applying right, because if I'm pushing negative, now I've got a bunch of gyroscopic precession, because now we're assuming, because you said negative, that I am under negative loading, and that unless I am negative 1g inverted level flight, I'm assuming that I'm changing pitch attitude,
right? But
you'd be reducing
your pitch attitude,
which is creating gyroscopic precession.
Which would be creating negative G, or right? Negative G reducing your pitch attitude. Wouldn't that be the same as you're flying straight and level and you do a powered descent?
No, actually, because what's stronger at that point is actually going to be the gyroscopic precession, the physical effect of the propeller acting back on the aircraft rather than the fluid influence of the ascending blade taking a bigger bite of air, and that bigger bite of air having an effect on the aircraft. You are correct in that dynamic situation that you are going to have changes in relative wind on the prop. However, in this case, because gyroscopic precession is a lot more physical of a force, it's going to have a greater effect on the airplane rather than the wind blowing on the airplane. Understood?
Yes, and I think that you've summarized P factor. I think gyroscopic precession you have not yet gotten to.
Right, so gyroscopic precession is the force that acts 90 degrees to the force applied. I'm sorry. Gyroscopic precession is the force that acts 90 degrees in the direction of rotation in the direction of the force applied. So if you imagine right now that you're sitting in the airplane looking forward, which way is the propeller rotating? It's rotating clockwise, correct? Now, if I pitch down towards my feet, imagining that the propeller was not a spinning wheel of death, and I could actually grab it and push the top of it forward, we would see how that would pitch the aircraft down, right?
Right.
So if we follow the spinning wheel of death, the propeller in its rotation 90 degrees to the right, it's like I'm pushing forward on the side. So the force applied and the force felt are 90 degrees off of each other. So if I am imagining I'm sitting in the cockpit and imagining that I pushed on the top of the propeller, the force of that push will be translated 90 degrees in the direction of rotation from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock in a forward push. I know it's trippy stuff.
Did you guys get that? I'm not sure if I got that. Let's ask.
Okay.
No response. Nope,
no response. No, I'm still not live streaming. So yeah, I mean, if you imagine the propeller in front of you is like a clock pushing at 12 o'clock, an analog clock, not a digital one.
Right.
Okay.
Pushing that makes all the difference. I was looking at my Apple Watch going, I'm really confused. No, keep going.
Pushing at 12 o'clock, the aircraft will feel the force as if it was a push at 3 o'clock.
Interesting.
This is a very hard concept to talk about without visual aids. So we'll have to do it without the visual aids.
$1 million.
Is it an evil force?
I don't have an Apple Watch, just to clarify. I got to make sure that's out there.
All right.
Okay.
So that's in a pitch down. Pitch up, it's just the opposite. It's like pushing at the 6 o'clock position, 90 degrees in direction.
Belt at 9. So pushing at the 6 o'clock position to push the nose up, it's going to be like the push was at the 9 o'clock position, which is going to have a right yaw at that point.
Yes, it will, requiring left rudder if and only.
And so, and that, in my negative G example, that's what's overtaking anything else and requiring, no.
That would be a positive. That'd be a hard pull.
Right.
Like a loop entry.
So in the first example, that's what's overtaking any other factor is the push on the 3 o'clock position, which is why you need the right rudder when you're coming out of that negative G maneuver.
Yeah. So what's a good one? In a tailwheel airplane, like rotating, like in a tailwheel airplane on takeoff, raising the tail.
Yeah.
You start with P factor, torque, and spiraling slipstream. And now you raise the tail, you just added a fourth left turning tendency. You start with 3, you add a fourth, and now the tail is up and the pitch attitude is level. Torque is there. Spiraling slipstream is there.
It was a push on the 12 o'clock.
But now we're done. Now we're done with it. P factor's gone.
Yeah.
Gyroscopic precession is gone because that's an instantaneous,
okay,
but temporary force. It's gyroscopic precession. So during that, happening during the pitch change.
During that change, when you're raising the tailwheel off runway,
yeah.
During that change, it's like you're pushing at the 12 o'clock.
Yeah, it's a pitch down.
Sure. So the gyroscopic precession would be as if you were pushing at the 3 o'clock.
Yep.
And you need more right rudder.
Yep.
Yep.
To counteract the left yaw.
Yep.
But then the instant that you stop that pitch change,
you're good.
gyroscope precession is gone.
Because the push isn't happening anymore.
Because the push isn't happening anymore.
All right.
And spiraling, I'm sorry, P factor is gone because you're no longer pitched up.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yep.
So let's talk about units of rudder.
Oh,
you
because
start with
well,
three
well,
units
because
of
when
rudder.
Because when you're on the runway, relative wind at that point, it's actually a pretty high angle of attack that you push. You push, right?
Yeah.
Because the relative wind is going to be coming straight ahead of you,
uh-huh.
and your tailwheel's still on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, got it.
Okay. So you were compensating for with three units of right rudder. As the stick came forward, you needed a fourth unit of right rudder. And now as the tailwheel is up and you're in the two-point attitude, you have applied four units of right rudder, and instantaneously, two are gone.
So let me ask you a question. Mind blown, by the way. Uh-huh. Mind blown. So let me ask you a question then. Does it help improve stick and rudder skills? Like, I don't want to say forgetting about the ball, but getting these things you've just said in the back of your mind so that when you know you're going to be in a situation where you have to apply rudder because your instructor's taught you that, et cetera, or you know the ball is going to be out of center. Instead, you think of it as what forces are being applied to the airplane right now? What will be applied when I make the change I'm about to apply? And kind of sense ahead of time how much rudder you might need.
Yes, and couple that with the visual cues. So yaws are seen by looking out front, and it's a motion from shoulder to shoulder. And if the aircraft is yawing and you don't want it to, you need to apply a rudder input. If the aircraft is not yawing and you want it to, you need to apply a rudder input, whatever that may be.
I feel like I've heard this before.
Yeah.
Maybe in a video.
It's possible.
Mm.
So proper rudder use is somewhat of an expectation of knowing when I'm going to need rudder. And I use rudder on loop entries because I know I'm creating some gyro, and I use just a little squeeze, a left foot on those poles in order to make sure that it's a nice, straight, pure pull. Okay. And, witness that the nose is tracking straight. So I'm watching for those things. I'm anticipating those things. But I want to run back to my runway story real quick. We're on the runway. We just brought the tail up. We've got four units of right rudder in, and now two
are gone.
Where's the airplane go?
To the right.
Yeah, go screaming to the right. Yeah. So the normal pilot transitioning to a tailwheel aircraft or looking for a tailwheel endorsement, their first couple takeoffs start out with aircraft goes a little bit left. They correct with some right foot. They bring the stick forward. The airplane goes a little more left. They correct with more right foot. And then, just about the time that they put that right foot in there, they stop that forward stick movement and that pitch, and the airplane goes screaming to the right. So it goes left, left, right. And yeah, so that's kind of the typical takeoff.
That's
for
good to know for next time I take a tailwheel lesson with you.
Absolutely.
Well, okay. So let's keep it simple. Let's talk about tricycle gear airplanes. So you're going down the runway.
You only have to compensate for two.
Right. Moving down the runway, it's pretty easy to compare the nose to the runway center line and kind of keep that thing straight. After rotation, if you didn't have a ball and you're just, you know, you're climbing a VY, how do you know if you're coordinated?
Well, I mean, to start out, use the ball. And
what if you didn't have a ball?
If you don't have a ball,
how do you know you're coordinated? Because with turns, you can look at the horizon and say, did the nose move?
Yeah. And if you're in a pitch attitude that doesn't afford you forward visibility, well, how does a ball work, Matt?
It works very similar to the thing you use when you're doing construction, you know, the long thing.
The plumb bob?
Yeah, you put it on and it tells you whether you're level or not. Yeah,
It's a ball sitting in fluid in a convex tube.
Uh-huh.
Okay? All it knows is what forces are acting on it. Well, I'm just a pilot sitting in an aircraft, and whichever way my shoulders are getting pulled, I am a ball. And in the decathlon that executive had, we didn't have a ball in the airplane. But I could sit in the back and go, hey, you know, give me just a little bit of right rudder. And I would feel it in my back. I would actually have a sore back, not from acro, but from trying to kind of compensate myself a little bit to keep myself upright because I was leaning to the right and I didn't want to be.
So then question.
Yeah.
Next time we go flying, after rotation, can you take the controls? I'll close my eyes and try to sense that. Maybe we do it at altitude.
4,000 yeah, feet. Altitude. Yeah. I can simulate a takeoff at 4,000
right,
feet.
Exactly. Yeah. So, because I feel like that'd be an awesome exercise, because then maybe I would be able to develop those senses.
And this comes down to the language of the airplane and you being able to speak that language. When I was learning Spanish, I was terrible at it because, you know, I didn't know how the sounds came together or what they meant. And it's the same thing with learning to fly an airplane. The airplane is telling you everything you need to know, with wind noise, with the sound of the engine, with the vibrations that you feel, with the forces that are acting on your body. And then what the instruments are saying is another part of that. And what visually you see outside, all these pieces and parts come together to make a stick and rudder pilot. So it's not just somebody that can handle the controls, but can also listen to the airplane and the feedback that it's giving them. That's what makes a good stick and rudder pilot. Now, in instrument conditions, you actually want to ignore your body if your body is telling you something different than what the instruments are saying. So in instrument conditions, take everything your body tells you with a little bit of a grain of salt. Just verify it. Verify it. But the ears and the eyes and the kinesthetic sense are all those systems or all those senses that we use in order to fly this airplane very, very well.
All right. Well, I think we're running a little bit out of time here. I think we've got time for one online question. What do you think?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
All right. So our online question today is actually pretty interesting. A pilot would like to know what happens or how do they tell when they run into a situation, whether they have a fly in their pitot tube, a fly in their static port, or both, or a piece of tape. So hypothetically speaking, I know that there are certain times where your airspeed indicator turns into an altimeter, et cetera, et cetera. But what's the rule there? How is there a trick people can remember, or is there, can you rehash it for our listeners?
Well, a very thorough pre-flight is going to go a long way. Make sure that all of those ports are open. So on the static port, on the side of the Cessna 172, you want to make sure that hole is unobstructed. The pitot tube has the front, the ram air hole. You want to make sure that's unobstructed. And then the drain hole, it's a little tiny hole in the back at the bottom of the 90 degree elbow. Make sure that's clear. On your pitot static mast, on your pipers, all three holes are on the mast. So you want to make sure all of those are clear. If you have a blockage in the ram air hole on the pitot tube, you will get no airspeed indications. You will get normal altitude indications. And if you see that on takeoff, if it's been 7-8 seconds and you don't have an airspeed indication, throttle idle, brakes apply. Something's yep. wrong.
That's why people say airspeed alive.
Right? Yeah, I mean, they're paying attention to that kind of thing.
And now what happens if you're at 80 knots and then the fly blocks your pitot tube? Does it stay at 80?
No. So if it just blocks the front hole, the drain is still open mm-hmm. to alleviate all the pressure that's in the system. So then your airspeed goes to zero because mm-hmm. now there's nothing to pressurize that system. And the airspeed indicator works by comparing the pitot system to the static pressure mm-hmm. and it just reads differential. And so if the system is allowed to bleed off back to static pressure, there is no differential, airspeed shows zero. However, if you have a blockage of the drain and then the ram air hole on the pitot tube, your airspeed will freeze where it is until you change altitude, and then it will act like an altimeter. So as you go...
because your pitot tube will remain static, but the air, right. the static port... will be reading the difference in air temperature, the difference in pressure.
Right. So as you climb, you will get an increase in indicated airspeed. And as you descend, you will get a decrease in indicated airspeed. This has actually brought down airliners in the past. It was no good. And then a blocked static port, you will have accurate airspeed indications while at the altitude where the blockage occurred.
Yep.
All right. But let's say you climb, you will see an increase in airspeed, an indicated airspeed, because now the pressure that's trapped in there, you will see a decrease an indicated airspeed because the pressure that's trapped in the static system as you're climbing is a higher pressure than what you're experiencing outside. And so what's going into the ram port of the pitot tube, the ram hole, is now at a lower and lower static pressure as it goes in. So you have a decreasing differential. So it'll still read, but it will read with an error depending on where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, if you have an alternate static valve, open that thing up. And there's a table in your POH about how to read your new indications of how things are going to be off, because the inside pressure in the aircraft is a little different than the static pressure outside. So there'll be a little bit of an error there, but mostly good. But that
won't really help you if the pitot tube's fucked, right? There's no alternate.
No, there's no alternate pitot. The only option you may have to clear the most likely case of a pitot blockage would be ice.
Pitot heat.
So there you turn your pitot heat on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if you've got some of the blockage, no, you're done there. I was flying an airplane a couple months ago, and there were two airspeed indicators in it, and the one of them was not agreeing with the other one.
Okay.
And we had a pretty good indication of which one was the good one, and so I just reached my hand up behind there and felt around, and I could actually feel a kink in the plastic hose that fed the pitot system into the back, and I just kind of fiddled that till it was unkinked and normal indications came back up.
Oh wow!
So it's interesting on install when the maintainers take these gauges out and put them back in. Unless they're pilots, they're not doing a test flight,
right?
You know, so when are you going to find this stuff? You're going to find it on your first flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had that too. I was in a G1000 that went in for maintenance. And was actually flying with another mechanic who didn't work on the airplane, and we didn't get airspeed indications on the takeoff when we normally thought we should. So we aborted, came back around, tried it one more time, got the same indication. And so we took it back, and the mechanics crawled underneath and went, oh, yep, that line didn't get hooked back up right.
Mm-hmm.
And they fixed it. Okay, great. And we flew away. And not a big deal there at that point. So. Those are some of the indications you're going to get. So yeah, does that answer your question?
It does.
All right, perfect.
And I hope it answers the person that asked the question.
Now, well. I actually have one more thing about rudders. So rudder butter. Apple butter?
Apple butter. I forgot to tell you. I was on a trip.
You told me.
In Chicago. And no, I didn't. I was on a trip in Chicago, and I was in a store called Olivia's, and it's a very nice store in Bucktown. And I was checking out, and people were talking about a bunch of stuff, and one person was like, I love apple butter. And the other was like, I really like apple butter, too. We should sell apple butter, I swear, in this store. And they're like, maybe we will. I was like, I'm taking that as a hint. Spread Aviation apple butter. Anyway, keep going.
So the other time that you need to apply a rudder input is if you are applying an aileron input or making a power change. Well, that's pretty much all the time, actually. So if any movement of one control requires the movement of at least two other controls. And gyroscopic precession is not just limited to pitch changes. Yaws produce pitches.
Wait, a power change in isolation?
Yep.
Without a pitch change?
Yep.
Will still add yaw?
Yep. Because you're reducing spiraling slipstream, and the aircraft is set up in a way that when you're basically at cruise or stable flight, everything's in equilibrium, and it's kind of happy where it is. So if you reduce the power, you're going to see a yaw. If you add power, you're going to see a yaw. And typically in American airplanes, power reduction, you'll see a slight right yaw. Power addition, you'll see a slight left yaw. You'll see these things.
So when I'm hypothetically speaking, when we're on downwind and I'm going to, you know, reduce the power to 1200 RPM, right?
Sure.
And I'm going to apply flaps, whatever. I know I push to basically make it so the nose doesn't really change pitch. At that point, though, you're saying that there would be some induced yaw anyway because of that reduction in, forget the flaps, there would be, because of that reduction in power, even though I'm not changing the pitch attitude, there's still going to be introduced adverse yaw,
and it may not even be noticeable.
Okay
because you're already at a low airspeed and low power setting in the pattern, and it's not that much of a reduction. You're going from 35% power to 20% yeah. power or something like okay. that. You know, it's not a big change, but making big changes like in the instrument world where, hey, climb maintain 6,000 and you were at 4,
yeah.
I'm going full power. Yeah. Well, I should put my right foot in with that.
Okay? Got it.
I'm going to pitch up. Guess what? I'm going to have some P factor. I'm going to uh-huh. need some right foot. I'm rolling the airplane left and right. Well, if I'm rolling to the left, downward displaced aileron, like my mentor said, I need rudder in the direction of that roll. And how much depends on the extent or the amount of aileron applied. If it's a lot of aileron, you need a lot. If it's a little, you need a little. And then once you're established with ailerons neutral, bank angle on, so like 15 degrees for a standard rate at our airspeeds, you still need some rudder in the direction of the turn to compensate for the relative wind lagging behind the aircraft and the aircraft wanting to weather vane back into that wind. And that's one of those things that language from stick and rudder kind of got wrong. He thinks that he talked about the airplane turning into the relative wind. No. Well, as an airplane turning by turning into the relative wind. No, it would actually turn away because the relative wind lags behind the airplane.
Right.
We don't manipulate where the relative wind is coming from. We manipulate the aircraft's axes and attitudes and create angles of attack. And that can count in the side to side or the about the vertical axis as well and create yaws on the aircraft. So that's one of those things where you need rudder in the direction of roll. And that includes rolling out of a bank angle. And you need rudder in the direction of turn to maintain coordination. And it's just a squeeze. Sometimes it's just a little squeeze, just a little bit of pressure. And that's to keep that ball in the center.
All right. Well, speaking of keeping the ball in the center, I think that this is a pretty solid episode.
Yep. Bye, everybody.
That was a really bad transition. So actually, I was about to say that pretty soon we're going to be at episode 37. So would you say we're running out of runway?
We are. Here. That's interesting.
Right? Yeah.
Whenever I don't know that I've done it, actually. When I go back to Kent.
Yeah.
And I land on runway 1, I want to call it 37. But it's not a good example for the kids.
No. No.
All right. Well, check us out on YouTube. We got lots of videos out there. Spread Aviation. Instagram and Facebook. Spread Aviation out there. We have t-shirts for sale still on the website. Yep. And Matt, I want to get a new one.
Yeah.
Orville, Wilbur, and me.
Yes.
I want to make these new
Gotta
ones.
Got to do. Well, don't say it because people are going to steal our
ideas. Keep it a secret, people. We'll have those on.
I do have one correction, is that we've been saying on iTunes, but iTunes is now retired. So yeah. So it's now Apple Podcasts. So you can look us up on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play, as well as YouTube.
And our website,
spreadaviation.com.
More content there as well. We got blog posts.
Yep. And the other thing I wanted to say is it's now been a year since Spread Aviation. It's now been a year.
Since it's existed. Yeah.
Plane Talk Podcast has been retired for a year.
Boy.
It's crazy, isn't it?
What?
Yep.
That's nuts.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. We'll see you in 2-9, a couple weeks, and have a good one.
Fly safe.
What is this again? Episode what?
28.
All right.
Is it 28?
I guess so.
Or is it 29?
I think it's 28. Hold on. We got to look.
We just released one.
You know that you're recording. I don't want to say, is it too often or not often enough when you have to look up what the episode number is?
I'm going with not often enough.
Not often enough. All right. Episode 28. Big 2-8.
It is 28.
Yeah.
All right. Happy birthday. Wait, no.
No, we have like another 7 episodes before we can happy birthday ourselves.
Okay. All right. That's fair enough.
Although you're younger than me, but how much?
December.
Right. So 9 months younger?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of wisdom to share with you.
Well, I can't wait to learn it.